You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. This is time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we take a look at all the news that made headlines around our region this past week. And our panel joining us live today, Madeline Beck with Boise State Public Radio News, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday.
Hello.
So let's see. Should we start with the State House? Because, Kevin, things are heating up a little bit there.
It was a little bit busy over at the State House this week.
Yeah, it was.
A lot of stuff happening.
So we talked a tiny bit about this in Idaho Matters with our James Dawson earlier this week. But get us up to speed with a bill, and it's dealing with transgender athletes.
Right. And we've been waiting for this bill to get introduced, and it was introduced on Wednesday. Representative Barbara Ehart from Idaho Falls is pushing the bill. And the effect would be that it would ban transgender girls and transgender women from competing in girls' and women's sports. And as you might expect, even though this was just an introductory hearing, it wasn't a public hearing, they didn't take public testimony, pretty sharp divisions within the committee about the idea. Democrats tried to kill the bill before it was introduced. That attempt failed on a party line vote, and eventually the bill was introduced on a party line vote. I think we know that this is going to be a very controversial bill, a very controversial issue as it makes its way through the legislature. I'm sure we're going to have a public hearing in House Education at some point. And you just got a flavor of that controversy in the brief hearing on Wednesday.
What I find interesting about this, I mean, many things, but one of them is it is specific to transgender girls and women,
mm-hmm.
not transgender men and boys.
Right. And I think what Ehart is trying to do in presenting the bill, the storyline that she is advancing in pushing this bill, is that she competed as an athlete, as a girl and as a woman. And she says, and she's very, I think, very heartfelt when she talks about this. She believes that Title IX opened some doors in her life and opportunities that she wanted to pursue. She went on to college as a scholarship athlete. She went on to be a college basketball coach. And she believes that she owes that to Title IX and to the opportunities to compete in, you know, in intercollegiate athletics. And I, you know, take her at her word on that because she sounds very, very heartfelt about that. And she is saying that this bill is designed to protect that opportunity for other girls and for other women, but the effect of the bill is that it would close off that opportunity for transgender girls and women. And John McCrostie, one of the Democrats on the committee, said on Wednesday, what I don't like about this bill, and I think there are quite a few things that he doesn't like about the bill, but one thing that he said was that it treats transgender girls and transgender women as not real girls and not real women, and that's one of the things that he finds disappointing in the whole proposal.
Do we know when there will be another move in this?
Nothing set at this point. The agendas usually aren't posted more than a day or so ahead of time, but that's something obviously we're going to watch very closely.
So last week, I know it was talked about on Idaho Matters during our reporter roundtable, and then Kevin, we talked about this on Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, where we stand with Common Core. Now, the Senate, as of last week, we didn't know what they would do because this was voted to get rid of all standards. Mm-hmm. Where are we now?
Well, we know where we are now, at least for the time being. Senate Education Committee voted to reinstate all of those standards. So the Common Core standards in English language arts and math are back on the books. All of those science standards that were approved 2 years ago, they're back on the books. So is a rule, a fairly significant one as well, on teacher certification that the House Education Committee tried to kill. So all of those rules are back on the books. What happens now? The Senate has proposed and has passed a proposal to create a legislative interim committee to work in the summer and the fall, in between the 2020 session and the 2021 session, on reviewing those academic standards and trying to come up with changes. You have senators saying, yes, we have to do something. We have to get some kind of closure. We have to get something that everybody in the education community can generally support and can have political support, so we don't have this ongoing debate. Whether the House signs off on that particular idea remains to be seen. House members have been kind of lukewarm to the idea of an interim committee. kind of mixed signals about that. So that still has to play itself out. But for now, it looks like teachers will use the same standards that are on the books. Schools will use the same standards that are on the books. They can continue to use their curriculum that they choose locally to align to those standards. So nothing much changes in the short term. But the debate continues.
I want to stick with the education theme right now and, Nicole, bring you into the conversation. First, talk to us about this series that you are doing, because some people may not be aware of it yet. But then the latest article that was just written, and this was regarding 11 schools whose Latino students were dramatically behind their peers.
Yeah, so I'm partnering with Idaho Education News with Sammy Edge, and we're traveling around the state to look at what the state of education is for Latino students in Idaho today. And so one of the story that we just published this week was we looked at the schools that Idaho itself has identified as schools where students, Latino students in particular, are dramatically behind their peers. There are 11 schools that are scattered across the state. One's in Caldwell, one's in East Idaho. You know, they're all Latino students there are more than 35 percentage points behind their peers.
35?
Yes. And when we're talking about this, this is like the achievement gap that you may have heard discussed mm-hmm. before. This means that if 75% of white students are proficient in math, then it means that Latino students are going to be 35% percentage points below that proficiency. And so that creates that academic gap. So we asked for the plans through a public records request, because every school that's identified for this list is required to submit plans to their school district saying, we've been identified. The state told us we were identified for this. Here are our plans to fix this. And the state, notably, does not read these plans.
What?
They're not required to. This is part of their implementation of federal law, the Every Student Succeeds Act. And under that act, it's really local control. They want the school districts to be the ones to step in to oversee some of these schools. So the state identifies which schools have this problem, and then it goes to the local school districts.
Okay, so then who is reviewing this plan?
The school districts, yes. But the state is not required to open them. It's not part of federal law, and it's not what they do. They can, of course. And individual schools can reach out to the state and say, we'd like some help with this aspect of how we'd like to help our Latino students in this way. But that's not required. What they're required to do is say, you've been identified for this gap.
So you looked at these.
We read the plans and found that more than half of those schools that were identified for this plan don't even mention Hispanic student improvement, or specifically, they don't set specific numerical goals like they're required to for how they're going to address this gap, which is the whole reason why they're on this list in the first place. Of course, some of these schools that are on this list were marked for a couple of things, but for this plan, they were supposed to set goals and say, we're going to move students from this number to this number. We're going to specifically help our Hispanic students this way. And here's what we're going to do if we don't do these plans. And notably, none of those schools had a time period or consequences, basically, for if they don't reach these plans, if they don't implement these plans. And one school district didn't even know until my colleague Sammy Edge called that they had been identified for a Hispanic student achievement gap. So
Which school district was this?
This was the Blackfoot School District. Yeah, so it's a long list, but they're scattered everywhere. There were notably there were four schools that did say, you know, this is what we're going to do with our Hispanic students. It was the three Blaine County elementary schools, and also Kershaw Intermediate in East Idaho. And they said, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to work on this. But a lot of schools didn't address this. Some of them notably said, oh, well, here's how we're going to work with English language learners. But that's a different category entirely. Only, you know, I've said this on
Well, you're making the assumption that if you're a Latino student, English is your second language, and that's not always the case.
And there's another category for this. Some schools say you need to work with your English language learners, and only 25% of Latino students are English language learners. Now, a lot of these schools on this list do have high percentages of English language learners, but that's not what they are identified for. The state told them, this is what you must submit a plan for, and this is it must address Latino students. And based on our analysis, it doesn't seem like they necessarily followed the federal requirements or state requirements for meeting these plans.
So what happens then if they don't follow these federal and state requirements?
It falls to the district. This is a local control. This is a local control matter. This is a local control plan. So it's the job of these districts to read the plans, to oversee them, and check at the end of each year and see, have you done what you said you were going to do? And based on what we're looking at the plans, people should also be checking the plans.
There's that.
Yeah.
I'm just that.
Yeah.
So no metrics yet because these schools were identified last year. Mm-hmm. So no metrics to say, okay, we've done X. Mm-hmm.
We're just looking at the plans. But of course, to get on this list, you have to have had this gap for, I believe, 3 years in a row. So it's not just a one-off, the school had a really tough year with their Latino students. It's where there's a persistent problem.
I want to switch from education. We will get back to it in the next segment. But Madeline, President Trump's budget proposal, a couple of things coming out of that. But let's start with uranium reserves, because this could have an impact in Idaho.
Possibly. Now, the uranium reserves, what he's talking about there is the United States has the most nuclear reactors of any country by far. We have 97. The next closest is France with 58. And then behind that is China with 45, right? We have a lot of nuclear plants, but that means we need uranium. Well, uranium mining in the United States has dropped just precipitously in the last 30, 40 years because other countries have found cheaper ways to mine it, and other countries have big governments backing them up, like in Russia. So we import 90% of our uranium. So the Trump administration and the Department of Energy have said, we should create our own reserve. We should pay the mining companies here to mine uranium so we can create this reserve. So if there's any international turmoil, that's we're set. Our nuclear plants can continue running. And so obviously uranium mining companies are thrilled. This could even feasibly bring back uranium mining in places that it's not as technically or economically feasible, like Idaho, where we haven't seen uranium mining in decades. But it will certainly bring back more uranium mining in our neighboring states, in Wyoming, in Utah, and states where it's got a lot of, where you've already got mines out there. Now, of course, you've got that other side that says this is a terrible idea. And those people are largely citing a couple different factors. And one is, we depend on other countries, but that's because other countries have produced it cheaper. Other countries buy our corn and soybeans because we produce it cheaper. It's part of the global market. We're saving taxpayers by having a diversified portfolio of where we get our uranium from. We do get some from Russia, about maybe 10%, but we also get some from Kazakhstan. We also get a lot from Canada and Australia and countries we have really good bonds with. So a lot of people are saying, this is just the Trump administration propping up an inefficient mining operation once again. And obviously, a lot of those groups are environmental groups who also have a big beef with uranium mining companies in general, who have just a history of abandoned mine sites, which are still polluting a large swath of different areas around the Mountain West. Navajo Nation had more than 500 abandoned uranium mine sites around their tribal lands. And so those are still getting cleaned up to this day, but they have some areas they truck in water. They're not supposed to drink it because it has high uranium amounts, things like that. So this is a big issue. And obviously this is a budget proposal, though, so we don't know if it's going to go forward. But right now the budget proposal as it stands would be $150 million paying uranium mining companies a pretty high premium for uranium in the U.S. for 10 years. So overall, it would be $1.5 billion going to the uranium industry in the United States to create this uranium reserve. It might impact even Idaho, but it will certainly impact all of our neighboring states. And so stuff might be trucked through this area. So that's that.
So let's, Kevin, continue on the president's budget plan because, $1.5 billion potentially for uranium reserves over a 10-year period. We can't say the same thing about education.
Right. And this is another controversial aspect of the Trump budget from this week. It proposes some fairly significant cuts in federal funding for education. And it's not just that there are cuts in education, there are shifts in where that money would go. A lot of programs would be put into block grants. The administration wants to put $5 billion towards tax credits to promote school choice. So there's a lot of controversy there as well. And a budget proposal is a long way from getting passed.
We're going to take a quick break and have more of our reporter roundtable right after this. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We are continuing our reporter roundtable. Our panel today, Madeline Beck with Boise State Public Radio News, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, sticking with our education theme because, holy cow, a lot happened with education this week. Madeline, some pretty surprising news coming out of Concordia Law School in Boise this week.
Yeah, absolutely. And the news itself came out of Portland because Concordia University Portland, their Board of Regents, voted to close the school, which means that our local Concordia Law School here, we're tethered to them. And so what that meant is that now we either could potentially shutter or we have to find new university backing. Without something like a university backing, a law school like this, obviously costs would rise, right? But they say they are already in negotiations with someone else to potentially take them over that wouldn't be Concordia. So they're saying, you know, it's part of our tenets to keep those costs low. We're going to find new backing, that sort of thing. Obviously, we don't know anything about who they're negotiating with. And so obviously students, faculty are all kind of wondering. But this decision to close the Portland campus just came last week. And folks at the Concordia Law School didn't know it was going to happen. So the fact that they're already in negotiations starting early this week and Monday, Tuesday, either means somebody had to know or someone's made some calls ahead of time or there were other law schools that are like, all right, we're going to jump on this immediately. Mm-hmm. They must have heard it like through the grapevine Friday night.
Or other universities that may not have a law school that want to maybe pick that up.
Right. Obviously, there's a lot of options. We're not going to know until they announce something. They've said that we should hear something about who they're going to be partnering with in the next couple weeks. But I just called today to double check and no news yet.
What's interesting about this, though, I mean, you feel for Concordia Law School because they did not know. But yet, this is the time of year where you start sending letters out saying, yes, you can, for next year's first year law students. And there could be ripple effects. I mean, until we all know what the future holds.
Right. There's not just the student sign up, but there's also potential challenges with, you know, making sure staff are on board, making sure they are signing their contracts for the next year or wanting to teach for the next year. There's a lot of challenges they're going to have to overcome because, I mean, Concordia Law School has already seen some of these challenges getting accreditation. Mm-hmm. They just got it last year. And so for the first few years, some students ended up transferring out and doing things like that because they're like, you know, if we don't have accreditation, what if we can't get a law degree?
We can't take the bar exam.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And I mean, to their credit, Concordia Law School has had, they said it's a 100% bar pass rate. So their 2016 students within 2 years, 100% of them passed the bar. They're only one of four universities in the nation that have achieved that, or four law schools in the nation that have achieved that. So that's a big deal. But at the same time, we've had all those struggles in the past. We've had these issues with students not knowing kind of what's going to happen in the past. So Concordia is really going to have to be very transparent and keep people in the know as soon as they know what's happening.
But those are good points that you make about maybe why Concordia Law School might look attractive to another university is that 100% bar passage rate. They are already accredited. So in a way, you don't have to go through any of that.
Right. It's signed, sealed, delivered. Everything's there. You've got good professors, obviously. You've got good infrastructure. The school, if you know it in Boise, it's beautiful. It's a big building, very central location. And right now they have 190 students. But with their accreditation, they were looking at getting even bigger amounts of students into that facility. So we'll see. I'll keep you all updated.
Well, appreciate that. Kevin, let's talk again about what's going on at the State House. So House Ed Committee taking aim at social-emotional issues in schools.
Really remarkable hearing in House Education Committee on Tuesday. State Superintendent Sherry Ibarra and her staff were presenting a proposal. This is a $1 million proposal that she supports, Governor Brad Little supports, to provide training for teachers and for school staff to help students who are dealing with social emotional issues. And this is it's kind of the education issue of the day, not just in Idaho schools, but
across the nation.
Across the nation, but Idaho has a high suicide rate. Mm-hmm. The state's own research surveying students found that in the last round of the survey, 23% of high school students said they have thought about suicide. So really staggering numbers. And that's the backdrop as Superintendent Ibarra is proposing this social-emotional training component. Members of the Education Committee were not convinced, pushed back against this idea in rather pointed terms. And our Clark Corbin covered the hearing. He has a full story at our site at idohidnews.org. It goes into all of the detail. One of the things that was significant about the pushback from House Education was that in turn, there was pushback from Superintendent Ibarra. You know, a Republican state superintendent working with a Republican legislature. Ibarra tends to be fairly deferential to the legislature, but when Clark talked to her after that hearing, she was agitated. She said, how can we say no to something like this? This is an important thing. This is an important program we need to get started on. This is just the beginning of the debate at the legislature over funding this or launching the program. But it gives you a sense of where House Education is.
So, Kevin, what were their issues with this? I mean, because when we talk about social emotional, I mean, yes, we have incredibly high suicide rates in our state. But you talk about kids who maybe their parents have gone through a divorce. I mean, it runs the gamut of how kids are, you know, the things that kiddos are dealing with.
Right. I think one of the things that jumped out at me reading the story. One of the lawmakers, Tony Wyszynski, who is a Republican from North Idaho, from Post Falls, was talking about, you know, thinking back to a time in the 60s, when, you know, these issues were dealt with at home and parents weren't afraid to, if a kid was, you know, acting up, to take that kid behind the woodshed. Drew a very sharp response from Steve Birch, one of the Democrats on the committee, saying, you know, I have no interest in trying to go back to a, you know, Warden June Cleaver era of the 1950s. So, you know, the committee was sharply divided on this issue. And, you know, again, as I said, Superintendent Ibarra, I think, is making this a priority. As I mentioned, the governor is on board with this. This idea came from the governor's task force, a very diverse group of education leaders, political leaders, business leaders, saying, yes, we need to do something about this. This is a big deal.
And Madeline, you've done reporting up in the Wood River Valley over the years. They are one of the school districts. They have a plan in place.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I mean, that's I before, when I had worked for the Idaho Mountain Express up there, covering the Blaine County School District, it's been something they've been talking about for years. They've identified specifically this is something they need to address. It's part of their strategic plan that they want to address social, emotional learning. They have a rubric for their teachers. For example, I mean, for K through second grade students, they want them to be able to, like, recognize and label their emotions, describe what causes big emotions, why it's important to control impulses. These are basic things that obviously, if you have that base layer, it could help you throughout the rest of your life, even as you're dealing with something as traumatic as, you know, a really horrendous divorce or death in the family or something like that. Obviously, those rubric goes all the way up to late high school, though, saying, you know, people in those grades, 11th, 12th grade, should practice more self-reflection to see if their emotions are in line with reality, to demonstrate skills that promote resiliency, identify personal management skills. How do you manage your time? How can you personally keep things together when everything else is kind of crazy? Mm-hmm. These are skills that pretty much anyone could benefit for. So, yeah, if the legislature does nothing, there's still going to be school districts like Blaine County School District that are going to go ahead and use their science-based backing to teach these skills to students.
So, Kevin, what in the world's going on with the House Education Committee?
Well, I did an analysis piece looking at this committee and trying to get a sense of that. And I dubbed the committee House Education Island because on an increasing number of issues, we talked about standards and we just talked about social-emotional learning as the two examples that I focused in on. This is a committee that's very conservative and very much isolating itself from the establishment thinking on education issues, the prevailing sentiment on education issues, whether it's academic standards or social-emotional learning. We talked about that, and I'm going to use social-emotional learning again as sort of an example of this. This is an idea that the governor supports, the state superintendent supports, the task force supports. Idaho's reigning teacher of the year, teacher from North Idaho, Stacey Lawler, has delivered spellbinding testimony on this issue. She has lived this issue. She had a son in college who was having suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. Her daughter was having panic attacks and had to work through panic attacks through high school. They both got through college or in college. They've both come out the other side of their challenges, and the family has come out the other side of their challenges. And what she has told lawmakers, and I'll tell you, I sit through a lot of presentations at the State House. This was one where lawmakers were locked in because it's such a personal issue and such a powerful story. She said, look, my family was lucky. We can't rely on luck anymore. We have to do something more systemic here. That was a message that House Education heard a couple of weeks ago before this hearing on Tuesday. And just one more thing about the social-emotional debate. While you have House Education raising questions about this, Senate Education, the chair of the committee, asked his members to just rank budget priorities. Give me a handwritten list of what your three top spending priorities were. I got a handle on the notes that they turned in. Four of the nine members of the committee said social-emotional training is one of our top priorities. That doesn't mean that only four of them support it, but four of them said, this is a big deal. We do need to fund this. So you have Senate Education, fairly significant sentiment in that committee that, yeah, this is important. We've got to do this. And House Education saying, maybe we
take them behind the woodshed.
Something like that. Yeah. So very different mindset in that committee.
We're taking a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable right after this. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable, our panel, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, and Madeline Beck with Boise State Public Radio News. Nicole, we are still talking about education. I find, but this is so fascinating. You sent me an article earlier this week from the Washington Post, finding that President Trump's rhetoric has changed the way hundreds of children are harassed in American classrooms. Would you talk quickly about this article, but also how it's impacting here in Idaho?
Yeah, so the story, it's not really a new story. We've been hearing since the 2016 election that across the country, there has been an uptick in not just children and students bringing to school fears about deportation, about immigration raids, about something happening to their family because of what they hear on the news or what they're or what could really possibly happen to their family because of changing specifically immigration policies. But also too, there's a lot of rhetoric coming out of the administration that is directed at people of color, at immigrants, and of course at Latinos in general, especially when we're talking about migrants coming across the border, ongoing asylum issues, and the border wall. We've seen it here in Idaho ourselves. We all remember what happened in Middleton. It's not a new story, but specifically, this Washington Post story talked about how they're seeing more reports of bullying and harassment that students are reporting that is specifically tied to this, specifically tied to words that children hear on the news, whether it's things like go back to Mexico or specific targets about speaking Spanish in class. It's not a new thing, but it's definitely been something that more teachers are reporting, more students are reporting. And in fact, this Washington Post story interviewed a student from Idaho who said that she had switched districts because of targeted harassment that she was experiencing. So it's, again, not a new story, but we keep hearing a lot more of it, and Idaho is definitely not immune to it.
And the beginning of the article actually starts in Utah with a kindergartner having other classmates telling him he should go back to Mexico. These are 5 and 6-year-olds.
And these are kids who, again, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the last segment with social-emotional learning. This affects academic performance. Students are bringing with them a lot of things. They're bringing with them the fear that their parents could be deported the next day, or they're bringing with them the fear that, just normal everyday fears. But then to also come to class and have an increase of bullying based on the color of your skin, mm-hmm. your national origin, or your parents' immigration status, you can't change any of those things. What are students supposed to do and also perform well in class?
Right. Well, and you're also making the assumption that they're not an American citizen.
There is that, of course.
I mean, there's that, too. Madeline, we've talked about this in the past, and this is light pollution. And as we all know, we have one of the greatest certified dark sky reserves in the world is up in the Stanley area. A new map, though, recently came out in regards to light pollution.
Yeah, so this map, it was specifically looking at, you've probably seen light pollution maps before, and you see big bright spots over big cities, lots of population. So this cartographer who was just moving from Brooklyn to New Mexico, who was starting to think about this, said, you know what? What if we adjust it for population? What if we start, you know, we start looking at the map kind of like you might see more emissions from cars from cities, but if you adjust it per capita, you'll see far less emissions from cities, right? So he did that for light pollution using maps from the National Oceanic and NOAA.
Yeah.
Words. Mm-hmm. And so
Oceanic and Atmospheric Association.
Thank you very much. So he used those maps and he adjusted it. And what you saw was, one, immediately see a giant bright spot over North Dakota. That's where they have a lot of oil and gas operations, fracking, that sort of thing. And a lot of flaring of natural gas. So they'll light it on fire so it doesn't go out into the atmosphere as it is. They'll burn it off because there's not enough pipeline infrastructure in some of those areas to actually reserve it, so they just burn it. So you'll see big bright spots over that, but you'll also see very interesting bright spots all around the Mountain West. Weird, really bright spots. Like one bright spot in Idaho looks like it's right over Sun Valley, and it's because I guess per capita they might get more light out there than in the rest of a lot of different parts of Idaho. Hmm. You'll see if you look towards the Twin Falls area, you'll see a lot of like little tiny bright spots, and those likely are farm. Different dairies or different farming operations. Obviously, the suburbs around Boise, you'll see a lot of brighter spots. So, but these are just really interesting maps because it shows that in these rural areas, you're also getting this light pollution. And in rural areas, it's actually means more because you tend to have more wildlife where it's going to affect wildlife. Just like humans, we've all evolved with only very natural light at night for, you know, billions of mm-hmm. years. And so now that we have all of this unnatural nighttime light, it really messes up rhythms. It may be a contributing factor to why we have pollinator decline. So these are all big issues that are tied into looking at these little bright lights per capita in rural areas.
Where can people take a look at the map if they want to?
Yeah, if they want to go to Boise State Public Radio.
Oh, well, there you go.
.org.
Just go right there and look for your story.
But there's also the cartographer who made it. His name's Tim Wallace. He works for Descartes Labs, and he posted on his Twitter,
okay.
and a little Twitter feed about what it means, and so you can check that out as well.
That's really fascinating, though, like to look at it in that regard.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up. Nicole, you were on Idaho Matters earlier this week, but for folks who didn't catch it, there are things happening in the State House that have nothing to do with education.
Shocking,
but there are. Aerial pesticides and what's going on with this. And quickly just take us back, because this goes back to last year with an incident that happened in Parma.
Yeah, so over Memorial Day weekend last year, there was an incident where several farm workers were hospitalized because they say that they were hit by a pesticide sprayed by a crop duster that was spraying the field next to them. Long story short, an Idaho Statesman investigation showed that not only did were a lot of these farm workers still experiencing
effects
and sicknesses and hospitalizations. Several people kept going to the hospital, but there wasn't a whole lot that changed. So what happened with the crop duster was the state ag investigators closed the case and determined that he did not break the worker protection standard because the farm workers were technically outside of this buffer zone that's in federal law, even though they were very close and they were on someone else's field, not the field that was being sprayed. But they did send a regulatory letter saying, we believe that you broke Idaho code because you sprayed in a faulty, careless, or negligent manner. So fast forward several months later, there's been no additional regulations or changes, even though a lot of advocates called for change because people were
sick.
Were reporting injuries. Yeah. A crop duster association came to the state house in the last couple of weeks asking for some of the administrative rules. They asked House Agriculture committee members to roll back some rules that lets the State Department of Ag, you know, mandate, restrictions on low flying or overpopulated areas, specifically saying that the FAA takes care of that. So the State Department of Ag has to have no.
So that basically they want less rules, less regulation. Right now they can't. They can't crop dust. What, it's a 100-foot buffer?
That's federal law, which also might change, but that's not what this Crop Duster Association is pushing. Right. They're just saying they're double regulated. FAA takes care of this. Federal law takes care of this. They want to get rid of some of the things that State Department of Ag does, which, to be clear, is very little. All they did was send a letter.
Right. There's a bill now.
There's
correct?
A bill that was just introduced on Monday that could make some of those changes and actually. Make it hard for the Department of Ag to actually enforce that faulty, careless, or negligent a statute because they want to restrict it. They also want to add some more clarifications to the law, but they're claiming that they're double regulated and that it's too burdensome for them.
And people can read that article at the Idaho Statesman.
Yes.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today. We've been talking with Nicole Foy with Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Madeline Beck with Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette.